We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. This year, the program, Focus, turned 30. And we've been marking the anniversary by bringing back some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape collection. These are shows that have not been heard in many years, but we think touch on topics that are as important today as they were when we first had these conversations. In this installment of what we're calling the Deep Archives Project, you will hear edited portions of two interviews that explore some basic questions about the arts, starting with the question, what is art? Arthur Danto is an art critic and philosopher. Back in the mid-1960s, he wrote an essay entitled The End of Art, and his point was not that people had stopped making art, but that in turning everyday objects into art, artists were challenging some very long-held ideas about what art is and about what it's not. Well, when he was a guest on our show in April of 1995, we spent much of our time talking about Andy Warhol's Brillo Box, a work of sculpture that faithfully reproduces a box of the kitchen scrubbing pads. And I asked Arthur Danto what it was about this work that he found so fascinating.
What I was really interested in was the fact that he was presenting works of art that looked so much like real objects, objects of a most familiar sort. Sort that everybody knew, like the Brillo box in particular. The question became urgent as to what distinguished the work of art from the real object. Why was one a work of art and the other one a real object? And it also became quite clear to me that it couldn't have to do with any real visible difference between them, that you couldn't tell by looking or as an exercise of some recognitional capacity which was the work of art and which wasn't. You could say, well, Warhol's Brillo box is made of plywood and it's silk screened, and the supermarket Brillo box is made of cardboard and it's printed. You say, but that can't be the difference between art and reality. An awful lot of the world's art is on paper and printed and so forth. And so it became a philosophical challenge to tell the difference or to try to see wherein the difference lay. That's what really got me very excited about Warhol. Nobody had ever done anything quite like that. And there were really two questions that bit by bit suggested themselves to me. First was that question in what philosophers call ontology. Why is this a work of art and this, which looks just like it, not? But secondly, why did this happen now when it was perfectly clear to me that it couldn't have happened at an earlier time, that there were constraints on what kinds of things were accepted as artworks at an earlier time, which kept that question from being raised. And I had this sense that it didn't dawn on me in 1964, but came to me bit by bit, that that what had happened was that one could finally see what I felt was the true form of the philosophical question about the nature of art. The true form of the philosophical question arises when you've got two things which really do seem exactly alike and yet seem profoundly different.
Was this the point where perhaps people started thinking about art in this way, that art was in fact not the object that you created, but was the act of creating it? That is what really art is. It's maybe the end result doesn't matter so much. That what it is, it's doing the thing. It's the action. That's what constitutes the.
I think that kind of talk was in the air in those days, and it's gotten to be more in the air in recent times, where you talk about the processes somehow there were. The artist to be located. But it's certainly true that there's a great deal of difference between the two processes, the process of making a Brillo box and the process of making, quote-unquote, Brillo box, that is to say, making a work of art that looks like a Brillo box. There is a difference there. And from that point of view, you're quite right that you'd have to begin to locate the difference in the process of thought that constitutes that as an artwork. But still, you're not escaping from the object. It's a very different object, even though it looks like a real object, as I call it at any rate, a real object, an object in daily life. What was intoxicating about the Brillo boxes, I think, is the way in which he did so much by means of them. He really did bring art back into contact with life, back into contact with, as I say, things that were in everybody's mind. He virtually defined the common mentality, the common consciousness of the time. He gave an objective presentation of what everybody knows without having to ask questions. What is it? What does it mean? At the same time, he produced an object where it seems to me, at any rate, it seemed to me then and seems to me now, required a fair amount of hard philosophy to say, why was it a work of art then, since it didn't look like a work of art, at least didn't look like anything that anybody had ever seen before.
It seems that as one looks at art history, that frequently when someone comes along and does something very new, it may be shocking, disturbing, controversial, cause a riot, and that in some sense there, that then we become accommodated to these things, and then when enough time passes, it's not quite so shocking anymore. And so I would imagine there have been many times sort of along the way that people have asked that same question. They've looked at some new work of art that was different, and they've said, ha, this is not art. This shouldn't be hanging here in this museum. We ought to just toss it out with the garbage. Was what happened in the 60s so different than any other time that question had been asked, or was there some sense in which there really what was happening at that time was sort of more dramatic in its departure from what had gone before?
Well, that's an interesting enough question. Often, what happened when people rioted, you might say, or whatever would have been the equivalent of a riot. Women fainting in art galleries in the 19th century and so forth. It was more that some boundary of taste had been crossed, and what turns out is that the boundaries of taste were more elastic than anybody recognized, and after a while you can widen them to include the new thing, and that's one of the tasks of critics, by and large, to reestablish the boundaries of taste and so forth, and that there's a real distinction to be drawn between something violating taste and not being a work of art. It obviously couldn't have violated taste if it hadn't been a work of art, so there was a paradox in that kind of reaction already. But it seemed to me that with Warhol, and not Warhol alone, it's just that he's the one that made it vivid for me, at any rate, and I'm the one I'm thinking of because I was writing about it in that way. But I think that you might look at the 60s in art as a moment when the same kind of thing was happening all across the face of the art world, where the same vivid kinds of questions were being raised by people all over the place, all of them of philosophical nature. What's the difference? This question gets raised by Merce Cunningham, the dancer Merce Cunningham. What's the difference between dance and just mere movement? How can you distinguish? How can you tell me that somebody just walking across the stage is not performing a dance? Just walking. You say, but it's just walking. You say, yeah, but it's a dance, as a matter of fact, and it's not necessary to get dressed up in a tulle skirt and go up on points for it to be a dance. Or John Cage in the celebrated 4 minutes and 33 seconds, where somebody sits at the piano and drops the hand, and then the noises of the ordinary world come rushing in. For Cage, that's music within those frames. and so forth. So music doesn't necessarily have to be something you can walk out of the concert hall whistling. These were moves being made everywhere at that time. Robert Rauschenberg painted, when he was a student already at Black Mountain College, painted an all-white canvas, where for him what was interesting were the shadows that were cast on it, and so forth. It became an occasion for thinking about very transient and ephemeral forms, and there was something, therefore, in the mood, one might say, of the '60s, of a where you were worrying not so much about what I've just called the boundaries of taste, as about the boundaries of art. Where does art begin in life, and where does life end in art begin? It turns out that when you begin to think about them, you're going to have to draw the lines a lot differently than you thought you would. Because up to then, I think, strange as a work of art might look, you still knew that it was a painting. You knew that it was a sculpture. Some of the most radical works of the century didn't cause riots because they weren't shown. I mean, like the Demoiselle d'Avignon of Picasso. No, people might have said, oh, God, that's not art, but they never saw it. You know, he kind of kept it in his studio for a very long time and so forth. But even at that, those kinds of objects, which were strange and distorted, but at least that turned out to be not to disfigure their status as art, but to be something within the framework of art that was taking place. And what Warhol did by putting rather bland and uninflected objects out there made quite dramatic the question of the identity and location of the borderline, and gave philosophers of art for the first time in history a serious piece of work to do.
We have a couple of callers here to talk with. We'll start out here with someone on our line number 4.
Isn't it really a question of, instead of I know what I like, but I like what I know? I mean, isn't there a kind of a sense of sweat equity in terms of appreciating art, that the harder it looks, perhaps, or the less I'm able to do what the artist does, the more I can appreciate it? Is that part of what that statement is about?
Well, I'm not sure, because when we get to an artist like Warhol, the concept of skill, the concept of the artist's hand, even the concept of the artist's mind is almost dropped out of the equation. There doesn't seem to be anything there that I couldn't do. That's one of the things that people are constantly saying about art. Anybody can do it, they say, and if anybody can do it...
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, if anybody can do it, what value is it? Incidentally, that was the kind of thing that Canadian critics, just about 2 years ago, were saying about two powerful canvases from the abstract expressionist period that the National Gallery of Canada bought, Barnett Newman's Voice of Fire and Mark Rothko's Number 16. The Toronto Star said the first 12 kids to come in with the best drawing of Number 16 or Voice of Fire will get tickets to Playland or something. That any child can do it is what comes in. The answer to any child can do it is not to deny that. The question is to identify the it, what's been achieved here. Is it that particular object or that particular meaning? And the meaning is not something that would be available to a child, because the child is just outside art history, doesn't know what it means to make a move in the sequence of historical moves that involve that. Virtuosity, I think, in painting, lingered on as a concept into this century, because Bouguereau lived into this century, but it stopped having the kind of importance and meaning that it might at one point have had, as the center of gravity in painting shifted to other considerations. In 1915, the Russian suprematist Malevich painted a black square that, in one sense, any child could have done that, any child with a ruler and enough manual dexterity to handle a can of paint, I suppose. But what does it mean that the child could do it? It, as I say, would mean making a suprematist statement, not covering a certain area with black paint. And that's what one has to recognize is the intellectual achievement, not the manual achievement.
Well, I do business with a collector, and I frame occasionally these. It's a Japanese artist, and he does black squares printed on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And the name escapes me. Even if I knew it, I couldn't pronounce it. But one time he came in with a catalog of his black squares. And to be honest with you, all I could do was laugh.
Sure.
I have there so much of modern art or abstract art. If you look at it, it's not that I get a story out of it or I can understand it, but there's a pleasant tone. There's some kind of color activity. There's emotion.
Yeah.
But believe me, looking at this catalog of black squares, which he was selling for in the thousands of dollars per print,
mm-hmm.
I just had to stop my entire life and question what in the world is going on. But of course, maybe that's what the purpose of the black square is.
It might be, yeah. But there's so many different meanings. The monochrome squares have played a really important role in 20th century art history. They've got a lot of meaning. I guess next to the monochrome black, the monochrome red square has played an enormous role. I began a book of mine called The Transfiguration of the Commonplace, which was my first major philosophical effort to deal with the kinds of questions raised by black squares, by describing a series of red squares, each of which has a different meaning and a different identity. You got to ask yourself questions like, how important are the corners? What kind of surface does it have? I began with this anecdote, which is kind of a funny anecdote. It comes from Kierkegaard, the 19th century Danish philosopher. He describes an artist who does a religious painting, and they come in and they see that the wall is painted red, all over red, and they say, "What is it?" And he says, "Well, it's a painting of the Israelites crossing the Red Sea." And they say, "How can it be that?" And he said, "Well, they've gotten to the other side, and the waters have closed over the Egyptian troops who have been drowned, and peace has been restored." And so I thought, well, that's really interesting. That's a marvelously witty reading of a red square by a philosopher at a time before any artist would have dared to paint a painting like that. But it indicated that here is the possibility that there could be a red square that belongs to, oh, the genre of historical religious narrative or biblical narrative. And in that vein, I began to think of how many possibilities I could find. I thought, well, it could be a red square, which is a piece of landscape. It's a highly stylized picture of a very familiar piece of Moscow landscape. And I went on and on and on. And then I said, and how would all of these be distinguished from a canvas that had just been painted in red lead by an artist who never lived to put a painting on top of it? And then tried to answer those questions as I went along, and through the red squares at least was able both to do two things. Raise the question of when is it a work of art and when is it not, and then what kind of work of art is it? And it all depends, a lot of it depends on how much you know about the context and what kind of meaning. And it turns out that the works take on a power and an identity, and sometimes can be quite moving when you see them. I knew a Japanese artist who did a beautiful, actually a man named Munakata, who's one of the great printmakers of Japan, Shiko Munakata, and he talks about, listen to this, because I found it very beautiful, about the black of the ink as against the black of the print, right?
Yes.
And it seemed to me that the difference, even though you say, well, what's the difference between the black of the ink and the black of the print? When you've made a print out of the ink, it suddenly takes on depth, it takes on power, it takes on meaning, and I mean, a book full of them is rather daunting, I quite agree, or a catalog would be quite agree. At that point, you got to fall back on the title, and too bad for you if you don't read Japanese.
One thing that in listening to you talk, particularly with this caller, that occurs to me is that maybe if one of the things, if the sort of dynamics, what's going on in a contemporary work of art, if that stuff is very subtle, I mean, if it requires some sort of close and careful inspection of the work, that that in a reproduction, in a photograph, in a book, you're never really going to see it. That a lot of this stuff, really to get it, you've got to see the real thing, which most people probably don't get a chance to.
I don't know how true that is. An awful lot of contemporary art consists of relatively minimal object, where the importance and meaning doesn't come out by minute inspection. Let me give you an interesting example about the Brillo box. Again, a student came in to talk to me about the Brillo box one day. He's a rabbinical student. And he told me that he'd read my book, and he went to see the Brillo box because he became really interested in what I had to say philosophically about it. He said, I'm going to tell you something about the Brillo box that you don't know. I said, okay, let's hear it. And he said, well, if you look on the Brillo box, you'll see a circle with a U inscribed inside it. And I said, you know, I never noticed that. I said, what does it mean? He says, that's the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. And that meant that at that time, Brillo was kosher. He said, it's not kosher anymore. So I know that the Brillo box was made before such and such a date, because the establishment of what's kosher and what's not kosher has become almost a science today. And Brillo doesn't make the cut, so to speak. And I thought, well, that really is interesting in a funny way. I mean, it does locate the work in its time, but in a way which doesn't seem to me to get at the real essence. I mean, Warhol was like a vacuum cleaner. He picked up whatever, or like a, more like a camera. He picked up whatever was in front of him. And sure enough, the next time I went down to Philadelphia to see some Brillo boxes, to show them to some people, and there was the little Union of Orthodox Rabbi logo. But I didn't feel that that's what is called for in connection with the Brillo box, minute inspection. By contrast, with paintings, well, of the kind that the first caller was alluding to, where the identity of the work is in the nuance of the paint, and where you really you can't reproduce that, where you've really got to get a feeling for what's under and what's on top of, and the drama of the paint. That I feel is true, but it's not actually the mark of contemporary art. It's much more the mark of a traditional art in connection with which connoisseurship plays an important role, and where a kind of refined appreciation plays an important role. What's characteristic of contemporary art is its conceptual aspect, and how you've got to be ready to participate in a certain kind of thought, in a certain kind of conversation, as I like to say, as to what's it about, what other art does it refer to, what does it say about the other art? Why is it important to know about it? And so forth. You could practically do that without experiencing, without experiencing the work.
Do you think sometimes that the reason that we, maybe some people find contemporary art difficult and more traditional pieces that have been around for a long time more acceptable? I guess I think about it this way. I think probably any work of art has a lot to, there's a lot to be read in there if you sort of know how to read it. But that we, because we really don't, when we look at a painting that was painted in the 1500s or something, I mean, we really don't know what the questions they were wrestling with were. We just don't, we just don't think about it. We just sort of look up, look at it, and we can accept it because we look at it and we know what it is, and then we move on. That maybe if we were in tune enough with what questions the artist either was posing or answering, maybe we wouldn't find it so we wouldn't find it so acceptable, or at least we'd spend more time thinking about what it is about.
I think that's probably true. Think that it's almost always been the case that there have been a group of people for whom painters painted, who more or less set the agenda, who more or less said, this is the kind of work we're interested in. There's a famous text, I was talking about it with a group in the art school yesterday, but by founder of the Warburg School of iconological analysis, a man named Abi Warburg, who literally deciphered a set of frescoes in Ferrara, which were done, I guess, in the 15th century. It was detective work to try and see what those were all about. And it was, he was successful, and he was able to demonstrate the court in Ferrara at that period had a kind of interest in Oriental ideas, Oriental images, and an interest in astrology, which of course everybody had, and that these emblems, which are very puzzling, in order to be understood, have to be understood in, against the background of astrological Orientalism of some sort. But I think that's almost always been true in contemporary art. You're working, the artist is working within a framework of critics, collectors, other artists, art historians, dealers, a group of what one would call cognoscenti, who set an agenda with, by talking and by having certain expectations as to what a work of art would be. I think that there's been a fairly small period in the history of art when artists just worked on spec. That's to say, they paint a picture and put it on the market. And when you do that, it doesn't, it's got to be pretty good looking, and it's got to be easy to get just by looking. I think in the 19th century, when the church and the state were no longer the big patrons and were no longer setting the agenda, then you begin to get private artists, and it's in that period when you get the Impressionists, for example, or the Barbizon school, people who are doing easel paintings and doing them to sell. And so they're of a smaller size. You can carry them. You can carry them home. You know, basically what's going on, and you don't need much by way of explanation. But I feel almost always the meaning of art is part of the network of theory, to speak loosely, in which the artwork is made.
That's Arthur Danto. He was a guest on this program. Back then we called it Focus 580 in April of 1995. He's Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Columbia University. He was the art critic of The Nation from 1984 until 2009. This year our program Focus turned 30, and to celebrate that fact, we're digging into our tape collection, looking for some interesting people with things to say about important subjects. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Louis C.K. FX is showing season 2 of his sitcom Louis, in which he plays a comic and divorced father, kind of like his real life. His prescription for raising kids?
Make them not die. Make them cool in the summer and warm in the winter. And then there's actually raise them.
Season 1 of Louis is now on DVD. Join us.
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. In part two of this installment of what we're calling the Deep Archives Project, we look at what has been a very contentious issue, now going back several decades, government support of the arts. In 1989, John Frohnmayer was appointed by the first President Bush to be the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. At the time, the endowment was facing a great deal of criticism for supporting the work of artists that some people found offensive. The debate became so heated that after only 2.5 years on the job, Frohnmayer was fired. When we talked in May of 1993, he had just published a memoir of his experiences titled Leaving Town Alive, Confessions of an Arts Warrior. I asked him whether he knew what he was getting into when he agreed to take the post of NEA chairman.
Well, there was a certain amount of hubris on my part, I think. I thought that I could negotiate this issue, just get together people of goodwill on both sides and sit down and talk about it and ultimately reach some sort of mutual accommodation. But I was in Dream City as far as that was concerned because of two things. One is that some of these issues are not negotiable issues. For example, the First Amendment is such a bedrock for America and what we have stood for in the past and what's really made us great that free speech or limiting speech is just not an option. But the second thing about it is that I found that when I got to Washington, solving problems is really not the business of Washington often. The business of Washington is churning the system. And for some of the people who were involved in this issue, solving it was the last thing they wanted to have happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do at one point in the book point out, I think this was in 1990, that more people wrote letters to Congress in 1990 about the Arts Endowment than about the savings and loan scandal, which arguably costs all of us a lot more than that paltry amount that goes from our taxes to support the NEA. And yet it's something that at least some people got much more fired up about. Now, one can say that's kind of disappointing, not that people would be concerned about the arts, but that people wouldn't be concerned about bigger stories like the SNL deal. Why is it you think that this was an issue that at least some people got very upset about, and it could be used as a very effective issue by some people?
To some extent, it is an endorsement of the power of the arts because the debate, at least on one level, is about the control of symbols in our society. And the artists are people who deal with symbols in poetry or in dance or in music or really in any form of artistic expression. And the power of those symbols is something that can be very frightening to some people who, you know, either are offended by the art or are confused by it or whatever. But I think it also is indicative of what I would call a conspiracy of diversion in our government. The Democratic caucus, which was far more supportive of the arts than the Republican one, in the summer of 1990, got together and decided that the two issues that would occupy Congress for the rest of the summer were the NEA and the flag. I mean, two symbolic issues, and not the SNL crisis. Not the economy, not housing, not health care, not any of the things that really Congress ought to be dealing with. And the news media, to some extent, is a part of this, what I would call a conspiracy in a sort of gentle way. That is to say, they look for the stuff that is going to grab headlines and in a sense, allow Congress to not pay attention to the savings and loan crisis and to spend its time second-guessing the NEA on issues which are fundamentally speech issues.
Mm. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I think one of the questions that came up during this time was the very fundamental question of why should government support the arts? Why do you think that it's important for the government to have that role?
Well, when you turn the question around, it really answers itself. Why would the government not want to support the most profound expression of its citizens? Why would it not want to encourage creativity and risk-taking and self-evaluation, the kinds of things that the arts promote? But sometimes that argument only persuades those who are already persuaded of the inherent value of the arts. So I would give you a couple of other reasons. the arts in education teach the kinds of discipline and the kinds of self-evaluation and the kinds of recognition of that we learn not just by reading and writing, but by all of our senses, and we learn this sense of intuition that we can trust as well as reason. Those kinds of skills are the skills of a great scientist as well as a great artist, and if we want to be competitive in the world as we will know it in the 21st century, we sure better be teaching those skills. And then the third reason that I would give is a very practical economic reason, and that is that our most positive balance of trade item in the United States is the export of copyrightable materials. I'm talking about sound recordings, movies, television, books, and software, and that industry combined those five things bring in a greater positive balance of trade to the United States than any other industry that we have, including the sale of jet planes and aerospace. The National Endowment for the Arts and the Illinois State Arts Council and the local and state arts councils throughout the country are the farm club for that industry. They teach the playing of the instruments that the kids then use to make all of the recordings that are selling zillions of copies. People that are great film stars now, like Joe Pesci or Gina Davis or Garrison Keillor or Spike Lee, got their start in the not-for-profit theater. And so, on a strictly utilitarian basis, how can we afford not to support the arts, which are the foundation for our most significant industry?
Hmm. Then to the basic question that also a lot of people raised at this time, at that time, this question about tax support for art that they find objectionable. I mean, how do you respond to that person who says it's not that I have anything against the idea of my tax dollars to going to support artwork? It's that here are a couple of particular things that I can point to that I can say that offend me profoundly, either they because of my religious beliefs or my moral beliefs or whatever, and they would say, I don't want my tax dollars going to support this material, whether it's written or visual or whatever, that so goes against everything that I believe?
Well, the answer is that one person's offense is another person's standard fare, and we as individual taxpayers don't have a line item veto. The government does a lot of things with which I personally disagree. I don't care much for tobacco subsidies, for example. I didn't particularly like the Vietnam War. The answer is that in order to have order in our civilization, in order to have a government, we do give up some prerogatives, and one of them is that we don't get to call the shots as to how each dime of our tax money is spent. I would add to that, though, that the amount of money that has been spent on art that people find objectionable is a micro cent per person. I mean, we're talking about now over 100,000 grants that the Arts Endowment has given in the last 28 years, and of that number, maybe 20 of those have been seriously questioned.
We have several people here lined up, so let's get right back to the phones and start with line one. Hello.
Well, good morning, David. Mr. Frohmeyer. Listen, David, I'm going to be fairly short and direct, but I do have a pretty good perspective on this. Mr. Frohmeyer, I'm one of those people you like to talk about. When I was younger, I was in a rock band and actually recorded four records that were published by put out by Epic Records. I had a computer software company, wrote software, and for the last 10 years, I've been an author of computer books. Almost everything about the National Endowment of the Arts, most of the arguments against it try to be dismissed on things like, well, it's only a few pennies out of your taxes, or there's always something that offends. But I don't want to make the strongest statement. I'm making the statement from the point of view of an artist. Government sponsorship of art is an oxymoron. Art has to be free. There is no government-sponsored art. It's certainly not. Look, there's oddball exceptions where someone does something great despite government funding, but there is no government art. Every time government, look, art is about beauty. Government is, art is intrinsically political art, and political art is always either about the trivial, the mundane, or the ugly. And anyone who tries to support the National Endowment of the Arts is arguing for something that doesn't exist. There is no government art. It's an oxymoron. Art and artists must be free to produce, otherwise they don't produce art. It's as simple as that. There's really nothing else to say on this subject. So all you're doing is funding a bunch of things, some of which we might, I might personally say, hey, that's neat, I'm glad it got done, or I might say, hey, I don't like this. But in the bottom line, that's the truth. And if we want to talk about the truth, we can discuss it. And David, it's fine with me because I'm hot on this topic, and this is one thing that's pushed my hot button because I believe in art. I've loved art ever since I was a kid, and to say that we can have government-sponsored art is total nonsense. It's utter lunacy.
Okay, we get your point. Mr. Von Meyer, go ahead.
Yeah, let me respond to the gentleman. To say that government spending art is an oxymoron, I think really makes a logical leap that is unsupportable. What the government is doing is being an enabler. The art belongs to the artist, and the government is only in an improper posture if it tries to control the content of the art. But if it simply provides the Hyde Park speaker's box, by analogy, and lets the artist express the artist's ideas, then it seems to me that that is an absolutely appropriate and, in fact, necessary kind of thing for the government to be involved in, because the government isn't just there to put some kind of impregnable row of missiles around this country. It's hopefully there to help us live a full life, or, in the words of the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness. And his suggestion that art is about beauty is, in my view, a rather narrow definition of what art is. I think art reflects everything about the human condition. And in that way, it holds up a mirror to our glorious side and our dark side. But the point is, and the point that he misses, is that the government is simply there to enable this to happen. And if the government plays with a neutral hand, then arts can flourish, and they have.
But David, what last comment. Yeah. And I know you got people coming, all right?
Yeah.
My point is that's an impossibility. And I think that the point that Ms. Frontmeyer misses. And by the way, Mr. Frontmeyer, I think you're a pretty decent guy, so don't take it all wrong.
My skin is very thick.
I know. I just want you to know that you and I have a very fundamental difference of a worldview. The point is, you say government's an enabler, and I say no. No, to the true artist, the artist doesn't need anyone to enable their art. You see the fundamental rift we have? You say it's an enabler, but I say no. Art is always its own. Yeah, this is a stupid statement to put it this way, but it's always its own enabler. The artist creates because the artist is compelled to create, and we have a free system that says, do what you want, and if people appreciate it, then they'll pay you for it. But to say the government's an enabler is to give government a role, frankly, that, A, it can never fulfill because it's not needed, so it's only a joke, and B, or presumptuous, that somehow an artist needs a government to sanction what they do.
He is of the view, I guess, that the artist is going to produce, in any case, you know, the sort of artist in the garret sort of thing. I do this because I'm compelled to do it. But the National Endowment is a counter-market strategy. It was created precisely because the market doesn't support the writing of fine poetry. And as Michael Newton said, opera is the next most expensive activity known to man next to war. And the National Endowment is there really to, on the theory that there are some things in human creation that are very important to us to have. And it's important enough that even though the market doesn't support it, the government ought to. It's the old Russian proverb that says we ought to help the untalented will make it on their own.
And again, next is line number two.
Good morning. This is really a kind of a divisive issue in a way, and I think that we're falling into a trap where we don't take into account the feelings of large portions of Americans in favor of supporting the feelings of other, you know, maybe smaller portions of Americans. Specifically, how does one get a grant from the foundation? In other words, take this Piss Christ picture. How did that get away?
You know, let me give you the general way in which grants are given, and then I'll tell you about that specific one. Over 1,000 citizens from all over the country, including many from Illinois, come to the endowment every year and sit on panels, and those panels are composed of about 10 persons each, and they are people who have spent their lives studying the particular art form that's under consideration, whether it's jazz or symphony orchestras or dance or folk arts. They judge the applications competitively against each other and against the guidelines that the endowment has established. They make recommendations. that it goes on through the rest of the process.
Okay, but an artist has to do a piece of art, make a piece of art, and then say, I'm going to apply to the...
An artist or an arts group applies, and just as an aside, about 94% of what the endowment gives are grants to groups.
Okay, so now here's the point that I'm getting at now.
Mm-hmm.
I heard the artist who made that picture, he was on NPR a while back, and he seemed like a reasonable person in the interview. But the point is this. I all around me there are like senior citizens, older people, they're all living in... A lot of them on government money, you know, that's getting paid them by Social Security. And then they hear about the government paying $1,000 for something that a guy was able to arrange in a couple of hours upstairs in his room when he decided to do something strange.
Well, you don't know that.
Crucifix. Well, wait a minute. I understand how you feel, and I'm not sure how I feel on the issue, but I certainly can see how a lot of other people feel when they feel that that's a lot of money to be paid for something like that. It's a lot of money. People are going out and all around this town and breaking their backs for a whole month and barely making that much money. So you see, it's a situation where, like the caller a long while back was saying, it's not necessarily a good idea for the government to buy art because everyone's conception of art is different. That guy could have done that picture and taken it down on the street corner and sold it, and these old people wouldn't be mad at all. They say, well, that was weird. There's a fool born every minute if somebody wanted to buy that picture. But for them to sit in their living rooms and realize that they paid for that picture is a totally different story, and I'll get off and let you respond.
Well, your point is certainly one that needs to be addressed, and I would say that what the government is doing here is promoting intellectual research. It's promoting the creativity of its citizens. It's trying to judge to find the ones that are most likely to do works which have the potential of being really significant. And we can't tell from the start point whether or not we're going to succeed in that intellectual journey, but it's certainly quite another thing to say that the intellectual journey ought not to be encouraged in the United States. And if you start that intellectual journey with the notion that you're going to do it, so you try not to offend anybody, in a country that's as diverse as the United States, you might as well not start the journey at all. So that takes me back to what I think is the fundamental question, and the only one that's really worth debating in this issue, and that is, should the government be involved in the support of the arts at all? If the answer to that is yes, then it must do so with an even hand, and it can't really worry too much about whether something occasionally offends somebody, because, after all, offense is within the realm of intellectual ideas that are protected by the First Amendment.
That is John Frohnmayer. He was a guest on this program. We call it Focus 580 then. He was guest in May of 1993. He served as the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts from 1989 until 1992. At the time we talked, he had just published a memoir about his experiences in Washington. He titled the book Leaving Town Alive, Confessions of an Arts Warrior. Today he is affiliate professor of liberal arts at the University of Oregon. This year, our program, Focus, turned 30, and we thought one thing we might do to celebrate is to dig into our tape collection and bring back some programs that have not been heard in a long time, and these are also not shows that are part of our web archive, and we decided to call it the Deep Archives Project. You can tell us what you think by going to the Focus section of our webpage. If you look near the top, you'll find a place that you can leave a comment. You can also just write to us at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, Illinois. The zip is 61801.